Robin Wright is a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World, and of course, a former reporter at the Washington Post. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let me play you a piece of tape from retired General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. He was on this program yesterday, and he said something remarkable about the Middle East and the fight against ISIS. Listen.
In the last week, the Saudi leadership has met privately with the Qatari leadership. They flew in. There was no news about it in the press in the United States. We knew about it, of course, behind the scenes, because they were trying to patch over their quarrel between two branches of Wahhabi Sunnism. And this week, the Saudis met actually with the Iranians, because the Saudis and the Iranians agree that ISIS is a threat.
Robin, that was a remarkable statement. The Saudis and the Iranians have met and are meeting, part of the remarkable coalition that may be taking shape, with the U.S. sort of taking a back seat.
Well, the coalition really is the centerpiece of what the United States is trying to do. It wants to build a coalition for a lot of reasons, to help give credibility, bestow legitimacy on the United States intervention for a third time in Iraq. It also wants to help defray the costs. It's turning to the Saudis and other oil-rich Gulf countries to play a role like they did in 1990 and 1991 in picking up the tab of Operation Desert Storm, pushing Iraq out of Kuwait. But it also wants to mobilize the Sunni world in order to have some means of communicating with the Sunnis inside Iraq. That is the core of the problem. The Sunnis now feel marginalized, isolated by the Shiite-dominated government, and the United States wants to see the Sunnis be the vehicle, whether it's their clerics, their tribal leaders, or their governments, in sending the message to the Sunnis to turn against ISIS or the Islamic State, to rise up against them, as the Sunnis did so effectively in forcing al-Qaeda out of Iraq in 2007. Now, part of that will also mean that you have to bring together a lot of players in the Middle East. And so that's where you get the unlikely countries of Saudi Arabia and Iran actually talking to each other. Now, that's a process that's begun, really, under the new president in Iran, Hassan Rouhani. He's wanted to better relations with the Gulf countries after 8 years of tensions under former President Ahmadinejad. So that has its own dynamic. But everybody in the Middle East is very afraid of the way that the Islamic State is not only reconfiguring borders, but posing a real strategic and security challenge to virtually every country in the region.
Well, ISIS is, of course, a highly ideological Sunni faction sweeping across Syria and Iraq, as you mentioned. At first glance, one might think that Saudi Arabia, the guardians of Sunni Wahhabism, might be kind of okay with it, at least ideologically. What threat does ISIS pose to Saudi Arabia?
Well, remember, just like al-Qaeda, ISIS wants to reshape the Islamic world. It wants to reintroduce the idea of a caliphate. And it wants a much stricter or purer rule than in Saudi Arabia. It's hard to imagine in some ways, but it is as opposed to Saudi Arabia as Osama bin Laden was. Osama bin Laden's first campaign was against his own country because it had allowed American and other foreign infidel troops to use the bases in Saudi Arabia to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. And so we're coming full cycle again. We're seeing the same issues that emerged out of Operation Desert Storm almost a quarter century ago emerging today. We like to think of the threat to ISIS just as to Iraq or Syria or to, in the long term, the West. But in fact, it is also aimed at the monarchy in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Robin Wright, Saudi Arabia talking with its old enemy, Iran, and these two branches of Islam, the conflict goes back 1,000 years or more, nothing new. Is this a sign of a fundamental shift in the balance of power in the Mideast, or is it a case where two enemies have a common enemy, they can cooperate on Monday, and on Tuesday they'll be right back to proxy wars, terrorism, and mutual animosity?
Oh, the core tensions still exist. In fact, one of the problems in Iraq is that it has a very strong sectarian dimension. You have a Sunni minority ruled by a Shiite majority, and that has accentuated the tensions between Sunnis and Shiites in the region, and that is personified first and foremost by Iran as the world's largest Shiite country, the only one that is predominantly or overwhelmingly Shiite, and Saudi Arabia, which is the guardian of Islam's holy place and the centerpiece of the Sunni world. And so there are reasons for Saudi Arabia and Iran to have common agenda in ousting the Islamic State. But when it comes to the future of Iraq, you see some of these core differences. Saudi Arabia does not want to see a purely Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. And, of course, Iran feels very vulnerable because Saddam Hussein invaded Iran and waged the Middle East's bloodiest modern conflict for 8 long years with over 1 million casualties. And so Iran wants to see a friendly government in Baghdad. And that means that the Shiites have to play a very important, if not dominant, role. So you have a core tension that will reemerge down the road.
There is that core tension, but then one has to ask what the opportunity is in this crisis for the United States. 6 months ago, the United States fomenting a coalition of these countries in the Middle East was unthinkable, really, for any reason. The depth of the crisis now has Saudi Arabia talking to Iran and Qatar as well. What's the opportunity here for the U.S. as it sort of looks maybe longer term at this shape of the Middle East?
There's something very interesting going on already, and that is the United States has been talking to Iran about its controversial nuclear program, and the deadline for that is November 24th. And on the sidelines of these meetings that happen at least once a month, there have been talks between the Iranians and the Americans in a very minor way, no big new initiatives, but at least discussing the fact that Iraq is being destabilized, the problems of Syria. So this is not off the radar, and bettering relations with Iran over its nuclear programs would go a long way to bringing Iran back into the region. So there's a lot of kind of shifting players, shifting moods that could play into the attempt to build a coalition in the region that stands up against the Islamic State.
But today, of course, Robin Wright, you're writing starkly about the risks to the United States of getting involved, the risks to the United States even having an Arab or a Muslim coalition in the lead against ISIS. What are the major risks that you see?
Well, the United States is relying first and foremost on the Iraqi government, and it was finally formed late Monday night. The problem is there are still a lot of disputes within this new government, and they still don't have a defense minister. They still don't have an interior minister, and these are the two pivotal positions in national security at a time that a third of the country has been literally seized by the Islamic State. And this underscores the profound differences within the country. The second vulnerability is the fact that the United States will rely on Iraqi forces themselves to actually fight on the ground with support from American air power and other nations playing a role in providing training, equipment, and humanitarian relief. But so far, the major players on the ground have been the Kurdish militia, the famous Peshmerga, and three Shiite militias, not the Iraqi army, which lost 4 divisions in the early sweep by ISIS across western Iraq. And the danger is that we can't retrain, reinvigorate, recreate the Iraqi military fast enough to take the lead in this, and that therefore the militias end up playing more of a role, wanting more of the rewards, the perks of military engaging and of taking back territory. And this lays the groundwork for friction down the road. This is going to be a very long process.
Robin Wright is distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She has a piece online in today's New Yorker called The Risks. Robin Wright, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's a video that by now you've either seen or at least heard about. Shocking images of NFL star running back Ray Rice punching his then-fiancée in an elevator, then dragging her limp body out, all while looking unfazed by his actions. That video surfaced yesterday and resulted in the Baltimore Ravens dropping Rice from their roster and the NFL suspending him indefinitely. But is it too little too late from a league who back in July suspended Rice for only 2 games? That was after seeing only part of the video, which the league maintains they never saw in full. until yesterday. Lots of strong reactions have been pouring out since NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's announcement. Former Vikings linebacker Ben Lieber said not to take attention away from Ray Rice, but Goodell and his suits saw the elevator video in July. They need to be held accountable as well. Assistant coach for the Chicago Bears, Chris Harris, said the NFL should have zero tolerance for domestic violence. There is never a reason for any man to be violent toward any woman. Former linebacker Coy Wire, I'd be damned if I had to be associated with him. Well, Don McPherson is a former NFL quarterback, Philadelphia Eagles, Houston Oilers, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Don.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. You know, this incident with Ray Rice has many, many facets. One of them has been to shine a light on attitudes and culture within NFL locker rooms, and we're going to talk about leadership as well. What about the locker room in your experience? Has this type of behavior been tolerated or ignored in the past?
I don't think that this type of behavior has been tolerated because it really hasn't been this graphic. And I think a lot of the language that goes on in the locker room is no different than the language that goes on in any all-male environment. But to see this kind of violence, there is a point where people say, whoa, 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 you've gone too far. And I think that's what the reaction that so many people now, even within the league, once they saw this video, has really taken a quick pause to say, you know, this is not just some guy talking trash, but this is really a horrific crime.
How do you see the league's and the team, the Baltimore Ravens, reaction to this crime in context? The cynical view is that the Ravens and the league realized they had a major PR problem with a star who was a violent assaulter, and they had to drop him, not some kind of magnanimous stand against domestic violence.
Well, I think that's exactly right. To be fair, the league's job is not to be judge and jury on all crime. However, the video of just her body laying unconscious and Ray Rice showing no sense of urgency to help her should have been enough for the league to say this is not the type of guy that we want in our league. And I think what has happened subsequently has really been a matter of trying to clean up a mess that really was created from a two-game suspension that should have, in my opinion, should have been expulsion from the league. And I think if you or I or anyone that we know, especially someone who has a public-facing job, was on video, we would not have a job the next day. And I think the same thing should have happened in this case.
Don McPherson, former NFL quarterback, thank you so much for your views.
My pleasure.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.